This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new unrivaled league, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Will Green, president and CEO of the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, and they've recently released their Louisiana-driven annual report. We'll talk about that and what they desire in the upcoming legislative session. Will, welcome to the show.
Will, how you doing?
Doing well. Will, the 2025 annual report called LA Driven that you guys release is kind of a summary of a number of achievements through the year. Kind of talk to us about some of the top issues that you guys were interested in and the kind of the state of those issues.
Yeah, Newell. So, you know, we talked a little bit about this last year, and you know, boy, what a difference a year has made, right? I mean, last year when we spoke, Louisiana was really, you know, we were losing more population than we were gaining. We were, you know, in the 40s as far as our tax ranking. We were in about, you know, in the low to mid 40s in our education ranking. We really were struggling to compete on a national and really on a southern with our southern states as far as, you know, projects and investment and growth. We had three of the top 10 violent crime cities in the country, and you know, we were really an outlier as far as most other southern states as far as growth, investment, and GDP. And so we, as the state chamber, State Manufacturing Association, we knew that with a new governor coming in, a new administration, new leadership in the House and Senate, new attorney general, new insurance commissioner, that we had to do something different, that they were elected to do something different. We, as a state chamber, we wanted to partner with them with a strategic plan to move the state forward. And we wanted to come together with economic development plan, with a plan on safety and resilience, tax and business, and workforce development and education. And over the last year, we, with the legislators' help, right, with leadership, passed about 50 bills that were underneath the umbrella of our LA-driven strategy. And then as we sit here a year later, we are now we average about in the mid-30s in education rankings now. And then the tax foundation has said when they predict when they come out with their tax rankings, we should be in the low 20s all the way down from the mid-40s. You're seeing projects announced like the steel factory that's coming, a $5 billion project. You're seeing Meta come to the state. You've got, you know, projects that are in the works now that we haven't seen in, you know, in decades. And so it's really exciting times to be in Louisiana. But Newell, as you know, I mean, we've got a lot of work left to do, right? I mean, we still have parishes that are losing population. We still have areas like the New Orleans area that is losing population. And so there's still a lot of work left to do, right, on safety and resilience. We've got to fix our insurance crisis. We're still among the highest states in the country on insurance. You know, we can get better with our tax climate. I mean, we're in the 20s. We can get better there. But in year one, we have certainly moved the needle, and we're certainly a lot better than we were just a year from now.
I appreciate that. I mean, you're not implying that all of this happened within the last year. A lot of these opportunities have been bannered about and were talked about and kind of came to fruition in this last year. That would be fair to say, right?
Well, I think that certainly some projects happen over, over time, but I do think,
let's take Meta, for example. That's been going on for 3 to 4 years, those discussions and, talking through that process, correct? And the same with Global Venture and a number of the other projects that have come to fruition. I don't mean to get argumentative, but it seems to me it's a little rich to say that all of this just kind of magically appeared on the landscape in the last year and was able to come to fruition. I mean, you guys have been involved in a lot of that work for the last 3 to 4 years, correct?
I think a lot of the work, right, you've got to lay a foundation, right? But I think you've got to ultimately close the deal with good policies that are put in place. And I think one of the things that we can brag on in Louisiana, right, is that we have a lot of God-given natural resources, right? We are a state mm-hmm. that has affordable energy, and we have access to water. But despite that, we still haven't seen the type of projects that we're seeing over the last year announced and really shovels in the ground, right, that we have seen over the last 10 or decades. And so I think what these companies have wanted to see are the kind of actions that we've seen over the last year or two, right? I mean, the kind of things like we were one of 3 states in the country before this last year with a corporate franchise tax, inventory tax, and income tax, right? And so now we've repealed the corporate franchise tax. We now have one of the lowest corporate income tax in the South. And if the constitutional amendment on March 29th passed, we'll have an option for the local parishes to opt out of the inventory tax. And so that's a huge move in the right direction as far as our tax climate goes. And so again, it's about marrying the things that we've had for decades, right? These opportunities that we've had for decades with the new opportunities and the new policies. And so putting those things together and working to really get the negotiations shovel ready, site ready, and the negotiations that have, been talks move into reality.
No doubt. I mean, I get that. I was just just wanted to kind of set the record straight that a lot of these things have been going on for a long, long time, and a lot of folks have been participating in hard work and trying to bring it to fruition, and we're better for it at the end of the day. Talk to me about this Hyundai deal. This seems to me to be another big, big deal, kind of like Global Venture. We have a series of big, big deals that have really kind of moved us up the chart, so to speak, on a number of different factors that are looked upon by industry across the country. This is, I think, a big one, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a transformative announcement, right? I mean, it's expected to create about 1,300 direct jobs and about, a little over 4,000 jobs in Louisiana. About a $5.8 billion steel mill in Louisiana. These are American jobs. I mean, these are good paying jobs. I think the average salary they announced is around $95,000 to $100,000. And so, this is steel that is going to be produced with a lower emission through this Donaldsonville Riverplex Mega Park. And so again, this is a transformative economic development announcement here in Louisiana. Unfortunately for years, we've been passed over by so many vehicle manufacturers. I mean, they've been going to Mississippi, Texas, Alabama. And so this is a big win to bring vehicle manufacturing back to Louisiana.
Well, if my memory serves me correct, I don't think we've had a new steel mill in like what, 4 decades, 5 decades maybe? Developed.
Yeah,
in this
country. It's been a long time. We have Nucor here. There was a facility up around the Shreveport area, but I mean something of this magnitude, it's been a long time.
What do you see I read through your report, a lot of great information there. You talked about out-migration still continuing to be a problem. What do y'all see as the biggest driver of that? Do y'all have any data on that?
Yes. I mean, look, we know that when choosing where to live, you know, people prioritize communities with diverse and affordable housing, high-quality education, accessible and reputable health care, and a sense of safety, right? And so that's why, you know, last year you saw us prioritize and look at safety and resilience, right? I mean, crime, but not just transparency and punishment, right? I mean, we prioritized reentry. You know, we supported bills like upon the release of an ex-offender from prison, having they have to have documentation like a birth certificate or a driver's license, so that when someone goes to look for a job, they actually have that ID, because that's the first thing an employer asks for, right? And we take for granted often that an ex-offender has that. And then GED programs in prisons, right? So that they're, you know, someone that commits a crime that's not going to prison just to learn how to be a better criminal, but they're coming out with a skill. And just trying to separate as much as we can, someone from coming out of jail and putting them into, you know, separating them from going back into that vicious circle and into a skilled trade. And then high quality education, right? I mean, we supported the education savings accounts, corporate charters, things like that, things that other states have done to try to improve. And then literacy and high dosage tutoring, things that have helped improve our scores in math and reading. And we improved, some of the highest in the nation on those scores. And so, you know, these are things that when young people are looking at coming to a state or moving to a state, or just anybody, again, education, affordable housing, healthcare, safety, these are things that more and more people are looking at when they look to come to a state.
Everybody always looks for the silver bullet, the one panacea solution to turn this around. I think this is one of the biggest threats to our economy is this out-migration, where we have middle to higher income people leaving and we're replacing with lower income wage earners. That's not a knock on them. They're absolutely necessary to a healthy and vibrant economy, but it's not a good trade-off, right?
No, that's a good point. I mean, we did our benchmark study that we did. One of the troubling things that we found are we do in Louisiana have a high young group, which is, you know, that's generally your, you know, middle age young group. That's your, you know, that's entering the workforce, and that's, you know, some of your mid tier, high tier earners. That is who are leaving the state at a higher rate. Those are the people you want to grow here, you want to train here, and you want to keep in Louisiana. In Louisiana, we do. We have a high labor force non-participation rate as opposed to the South. We have one of the highest in the South. We have about a 58.5% current labor force participation rate. And so to close that gap, we need about an additional 145,000 jobs. And so one of the things that we're looking at is prioritizing early childhood investment and early childhood education, and making the business case for early childhood investment. When we did, we looked at a study that was done a couple of years ago, Noel, and it says that 1 in 7 Louisiana residents with a child aged 4 or under turned down a promotion at work due to child care issues. 1 in 6 were forced to quit a job. 1 in 13 were fired because of child care issues. And so, if we can expand access to high quality early childhood education, if we can make it affordable and we can expand access to it, we think that there's a huge percentage of that non-participating labor force that's out there that we can fill in those jobs. And so we think that's one way that we can fill the need there.
How do we go about doing that, Will, when we our average costs, our average spend per student in Louisiana is one of the highest in the country?
Well, I mean, I think things like education savings accounts is a big thing, right? I mean, I think letting a parent have control over their tax dollars, a parent knows what's best for their tax dollars. And I know the governor's prioritized that. I know that in his budget, he put dollars in there for the education savings accounts, right? That's state dollars. You know, a parent knows that if their kid is either in a, you know, it doesn't even have to be a failing school, right? I mean, what if their kid learns better in a smaller environment and unfortunately the class size is too big for them? Or what if the kid needs, you know, extra tutoring and, you know, use their state tax dollars for extra tutoring, you know, or needs books or needs computers or needs just extra skills? Or if they are in a failing school and they want to use their state tax dollars to put their kid in a more successful school for them. You know, that's why we supported the education savings account legislation last year, the LA Gator scholarship program.
And that really hadn't hit full stride yet. That's going to be, I guess, this upcoming school year. Is that correct?
So the program did get kicked off. The governor put money in there for his funding. There's different variations of that. The first year, it's students currently enrolled that meet a certain threshold of poverty. It'll expand. It'll, you know, the threshold will lower a little bit over the next year, and then students enrolled, you know, coming into kindergarten, and then hopefully after several years it'll expand and it'll be a universal program.
In the upcoming legislative session, I know you guys always have an agenda. What are kind of the top three things that y'all are looking to achieve in this session?
Yes, I mean, obviously insurance is the number one issue that we find our members are facing right now. I mean, we're among the highest cost state for insurance in the country. And so, as you know, as we did last year, we'll be prioritizing in insurance reform, trying to make our state more attractive to insurance carriers who write here. What we do know is there's no silver bullet, right? I mean, there's no one bill that we can pass that's going to, you know, snap your fingers and your insurance rates are going to reduce overnight. But what we do know is we can, you know, we can do things like Florida's done, like you just saw Georgia do. The Georgia governor prioritized tort reform, insurance reform. Arkansas just passed significant insurance reform. We can do things like these states have done to signal to insurance companies that we're back open for business, come back and write here with confidence. And we know that with more insurance carriers writing here, there's more options. And with more options, there's more competition. And with competition, that helps decrease rate pressure. And so we'll be prioritizing things like medical cost transparency, letting the jury see not only what was billed, but what was actually paid. And that helps reduce phantom damages in jury awards. And that results in more accurate jury awards and settlements. So we'll be prioritizing insurance reform. We'll be prioritizing, you know, what I just talked about, early childhood education and workforce development. We'll be looking at, you know, more tax and budget reform, cleaning up some of the, you know, some of the things that were done in the tax special session, continue to work on, digital goods legislation, continuing to work on, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what can we do to totally remove the inventory tax at the local level, or if we can't totally remove the inventory tax, you know, can we do something with the credit, just to continue to make our state more attractive place to do business.
Yeah, I hope in that process it's really a full-fledged conversation as it relates to tort reform. Because I just think there are a lot of variables that are left out of the conversation and that they create balance. And a lot of our folks, you know, we hear this word tort reform, and it's all great until they get in an accident and they become the victim of tort reform. And they're not able to advocate for themselves appropriately to make sure that they are made whole. And, you know, and it sometimes we go too far. So it'd be interesting to follow that conversation. I think people would be a lot more likely to support it if we recognize the balance of interest.
Because some of the
predatory actions of not only health insurance, automobile insurers, property insurers, and others, we never really talk about that a lot. And it's all like it's a made-up story. I can tell you that, you know, I drove a public vehicle for most of my adult life. I now have a private vehicle. I get hit by somebody back in August. It's been a disaster. I mean, the games that are played, it's just unbelievable. And I've never seen that side because I've never had to handle it. And, you know, but now that I have
it, it's a good point. And I think the point, Newell, the point is let's bring some certainty and some predictability and some transparency into our legal system so we don't have these long drawn out cases. We don't have all the fighting back and forth, and because that's other states just don't have that. I mean, they don't. It's not as complicated as we have here in our system. And that's why I think you've seen Florida, Georgia, Arkansas get behind medical transparency bills, because what the whole idea behind it is, right, is that you're supposed to be made whole. If you're injured and you have a medical bill and you're and the other party's at fault, you're supposed to be made whole. And so what we're advocating for with this medical transparency legislation is when you get hurt, you have a medical bill, insurance pays their portion of that medical bill, and the jury gets to see what was billed and what was actually paid. And the jury gets to decide if they want to award what was billed or what was actually paid. And so the injured party, all they're out is what was actually paid, right? Not what was actually billed. And so the injured party is going to be made whole either way.
And well, not so fast, because let me tell you what's going on that I just found out in the industry. They have these auto explosion provisions where the health insurance provider is putting an arbitrary number on a claim if you are in an accident. And let's just say it's $10,000. So the insured is then compelled to have to deal with the guilty party. Insurance. If they balk, then they got to go against their UM coverage in order to get that $10,000 that they have to pay out first before their health insurance provider pays it out, even though they're entitled to subrogate to that claim. They are removing themselves further and further away from the claim because they don't want to bear that cost and they don't want to wait in order to be paid. What happens in the interim is that the insured is burdened with the total cost of the MRI, the CAT scan, or otherwise, and they don't get the benefit now of the reduced cost, the leverage cost reduction because of the discounting. So they're facing these bills that they're having to come out of pocket with, and it is absolutely destroying people financially.
But the jury would see that under this legislation.
Legislation. But when we talk about transparency, what we've done is we've taken lower income people and destroyed them, because they're having to pay the full freight because their health insurance provider is not standing up and providing it and willing to subrogate to those claims, and we don't talk about that. And you want to know why they run into court? Why they run into a lawyer? Because a lawyer is going to finance all of that for them, and it's the only way that they're going to be able to survive financially. Y'all need to look into that, because that is becoming a growing trend here in Louisiana. I don't know why. I can't imagine it's not a growing trend in other areas, because a lot of these are national health insurance providers that are doing this. And a lot of it is in self-insured that's being managed by big providers. It's just an aside. I mean, I just throw that out.
No, but
be aware of this practice.
This bill,
it's a growing trend.
Would see that, though. Yeah, to be clear,
yeah,
the jury would be able to see that and award that.
But you're trying to avert the litigation. The reason they're running to the litigation is they got somebody's got to help them finance this in the interim. And so they're running to lawyers. Right.
Well, this legislation deals with the litigation, though. No, it doesn't avoid the litigation. This says in a litigated case, the jury sees what's billed and what's paid.
But we always ask, why is litigation so high in Louisiana? It's high because of what some of these folks have done. We've got this bad rap of being, you know, horrible in this area. So they've put these super aggressive.
Actually, here's the problem with Louisiana. We don't necessarily litigate more than other states. The problem is that for one litigated case in Louisiana, we cost about three times more than other states. And the reason for that is because the jury doesn't get the whole picture. And so what this bill does is it says, show the jury the whole picture. Show them what was actually paid and what was actually charged. We don't do that now, and it results in about three times the awards of other states. And that's why we have about three times the insurance cost of other states. And so cost in Louisiana. And that's what we're saying. So we agree with that, Noel. And that's absolutely what this bill does. And we think it's common sense. We're not trying to take any rights away from anybody. At the end of the day, I'm an attorney. Sometimes you got to litigate, and we know that. And all we want to say is when you do have to litigate in that worst case scenario case, let's let all the evidence come in and let the dominoes fall. But let's make sure it's all the evidence is in.
No doubt, for sure. As always, Will, thank you so much for joining us. We truly appreciate your time. We're going to get you back on as well, because we got a lot of other issues to talk about, too. So
thank you so much for joining us.
All righty, sir. Thank you. Will Green, President and CEO of the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. Check out their report. You can go to their website. It's called the Lobby Lowdown, Louisiana-Driven Annual Report. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog, relative to a couple of cases dealing with DWI and the way that the lack of disciplinary action occurred. Skip, welcome to the show.
Morning. How you doing? Well, afternoon. How are you doing?
So, Skip, tell us about these cases.
These are two that are pretty egregious, where the officers clearly tried to influence the officer that pulled him over, got argumentative, pointed at a passenger in both cases, saying the other person was a driver, although there was plenty of evidence to suggest that they were the drivers. Both finally admitted that they were at different points the driver. But in just one of the officers' cases, I counted six different reasons why this was improper in their own investigation. The story continually changed if you read through their PIV investigation. I wasn't driving the vehicle. I don't remember the event. I had a COVID vaccine. A friend of mine died. Improper investigation. My drink was spiked. All of those came in just one investigative report. It seems like you're trying to nail down someone that it really knows the tricks of the trade and is trying to get out of this. And I think if you were able to watch the entire videos, you would see something that where officers are treated quite preferentially when something like this happens. Very much different than, say, you or I.
I actually saw the videos. I read the PIB reports that you provided for me as well. And what really kind of struck me in the report is at the end of the report, there was, findings made as to what violations they were of SOP, within the department. And but no recommendation as it related to disciplinary action. They were placed on administrative duty, and I found the whole report just void of, okay, so they are guilty of the following, but no recommendation. I found that odd. I mean, having handled every internal affairs complaint from 1995 through 2007, before I became sheriff, they all came across my desk for my review, and there would never be this type of report that would go up without a recommendation for disciplinary action.
And it used to be routine that if an officer was found had committed a DWI, it's a criminal offense and they were dismissed. And that makes a lot of sense. You can imagine if you're a bus driver or an ambulance driver, if you have a DWI in your background, you've lost your job or you don't get that job. And we have officers now that once they're in these programs or once they're in these diversion programs that they're often cycled into, they can't be an officer for a while. They're not allowed to have a gun. They're not allowed to be in uniform, and they're not allowed to drive a vehicle. And we now have these sort of lame duck officers with a criminal background who, again, if you read these reports, even the reports state that the officers weren't found to be credible, meaning their own statements were contradictory and contradicted their own statements. And as you're familiar with administrative hearings on officers, you're required to be honest, and the penalty is dismissal from your job. And yet both these officers are still employed at the NOPD.
We at JPSO gave officers second chances in some cases, but never where they didn't readily admit from the very beginning that they had violated the law. Never when they treated the investigating officer in a bad way. And more importantly, that they were honest throughout the process and did not lie. You know, interesting here in one of these cases, when interviewed in the aftermath of going through the diversion program and everything else, the investigative officer, and appropriately so, asked the officer that was under investigation, "Were you drunk?" And even though he knows that his blood alcohol content was 0.15, almost twice the legal limit, he said no. And one of the conditions of being in diversion is that you have to admit that you are in fact guilty of driving while intoxicated. But even months after he had completed the diversion program, he still adamantly, within the confines of the NOPD investigation, denies being drunk. And that seemed to me to be more remarkable than anything that I've ever seen, because he's been given the second chance through the diversion. He's given the second chance through the course of this investigation by being administratively reassigned, and still, almost, I think it was almost a year after the incident, says, "I wasn't drunk."
Yes. And again, these two.
And by the way, state troopers are not my peers. I mean, what do you do with that individual who's now working inside a department where state troopers are actually working side by side with these people each and every day? And he doesn't consider them, you know, law enforcement. That I thought was a very troubling happenstance here, that no one made the observation and connected the dot during the course of the investigation of what is required in diversion and what this officer is actually saying after he completed diversion, that I wasn't drunk.
Yes. And if you get to see the entire video, and it's substantial, one of the officers continues to repeatedly swear and degrade the state trooper, repeatedly, over and over and over again. It is so abusive. And so I've read the state trooper's report of him pulling the officer over, and it is it's very pleasant. He was very forgiving of that NOPD officer, even though he was really harshly treated and had to really call in help from Jefferson Parish to make sure that, you know, keep everything under control, because the officer was barely in control. But some of the statements that he made.
So what's the reaction been from NOPD? I know that you've asked, you know, of them, what is the policy here? Where are they going? I mean, any response? Why don't we do this? Hold that. Let us get to a break. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. And we left off, Skip, wondering whether or not there's been any response to the story that has been done on these two cases from the NOPD.
You know, one of the interesting points that brings up, and if your listeners are interested, you can go see this. David Hammer reported on this on WWL-TV. But one of the officers managed to go from a very reasonable pay of $74,000+. And the next year, his pay was $243,000. He clearly didn't suffer financially and doesn't seem that it's hindered his career significantly. Even last year, his compensation was over $233,000. When you have officers like this that certainly don't bring credit to the force, how is the compensation justified here? I think most people would be pretty shocked to know that we have officers that are pushing $250,000 in compensation. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Was that details included, or was that just overtime?
That does include details. In the particular case, there were about $40,000 in details and $203,000 in NOPD time for the year 2023. So, in the following year, it was $209,000 in 24 in NOPD time, and then $23,000 in details for a total of $233,000 in 2024.
So there had to have been a lot of overtime in that number then, right?
There could be, or it could also be Lakeview details, or because those are embedded into NOPD time, Lakeview details, Mid-City details, or French Quarter Task Force time. But the numbers are pretty outstanding. And in 2023, he was among the top 10 highest paid officers in the NOPD. A year after he basically got off his diversion program. You just have to wonder what kind of oversight is going on there, that where you have a problem officer. And just one of his statements, that one of the officers made as he was being arrested is basically referring to the state trooper. He says, "Before he leaves Gretna, I'll be out." Meaning, you know, he's going to pull some strings and he'll be out of jail.
There were a number of statements involved through that whole process that were somewhat problematic, disrespectful, and otherwise. I don't know. It would seem to me that somebody in NOPD administration, it would have called attention. There would have been some attention paid to that. One of the cases was resolved under Superintendent Sean Ferguson. The other one under Interim Superintendent Michelle Woodfork. And just is emblematic of a bigger issue. I'm kind of curious whether or not this would still go on, but one of them was resolved in 2023, I think, if my memory serves me correct. We got to get to a break. I apologize, Skip. We've run out of time. We're visiting with Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. We'll have you back on, Skip. We got to get to a break, though. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, we'll talk about a little blunder at the White House, but a lot of people say it's not a very big deal. Also, a Trump faith advisor is promising seven supernatural blessings for $1,000. Even God going after your enemies. You know, that's a pretty good deal. I mean, you divide seven into 1,000 for a supernatural blessing. I think that's a hell of a deal. So we'll talk about that coming up.
Scoot's up next. Stay tuned, folks. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Tuesday evening. We'll see you again in the morning.